Thank you very much, Rabbi Shore. You guys can hear me? Give me a thumbs up if you hear me. Your video's on? Okay, great. Thank you for the introduction. I also started on the high school basketball team, so that would have been worthwhile to mention, and also it would have been helpful if you mentioned that to also leave out that my brother was the coach. But it was good enough introduction. Thank you. So welcome everyone to the Kol Yom Rishon. This is my first time here, and I'm sure some of you it's your 100th time here. It's a very exciting program, and it's very exciting to be a part of it. I want to discuss today a timely matter. It's timely and timeless. It has very much to do, as you can tell from the title, with FaceTime, with technology, with something that's on our minds over the last couple of months in particular, sharing Torah, transmitting the Mesorah over FaceTime. But I wanted to go a little bit deeper and try to dig back into our collective, national memory, into the concept of Mesorah, the concept of tradition, the concept of Talmud Torah and teaching Torah, and try to glean some insight from some past stories in history, some things that we reckon with all the time, every day in Mishnayos and Gemara, and in other such works, and try to bring some of the messages back to our time and apply it to how we're going to go through these months that we're in right now and moving forward, Mirz Hashem, as we leave this time of the pandemic. So I didn't give out Makoro sheets. I didn't give out source sheets, and that's because we're going to share slides. So I'm going to open up that for you right now. And if you could see, you'll give me a thumbs up also. Great, you see the slides, awesome. So I should just start by thanking, I have Rebbeim who helped me with learning and with teaching, obviously. I also have a Rebbe in graphic design, in slides. So I thank my Rebbe in slides, Rabbi Nathan Farber of Style.Fame, for helping me prepare these slides to make them a little bit more palatable for the audience. So our title, as you heard, is Poor Connection, Transmitting Torah Over FaceTime. Now, what we want to discuss is actually an interesting phenomenon in general, but we'll start with an interesting phenomenon in a certain point in history with which everyone is familiar. The story goes as follows. The Baal Shem Tov was the founder of Chassidus. So when the Baal Shem Tov was giving over all of the Mahalach, all the approach of Chassidus in general, so he didn't really write anything down. He never wrote his own Svarim. All of the things you'll find in the name of the Baal Shem Tov, they'll either be Divrei Torah you've heard about from mouth to mouth over the generations, or you'll find things written down in Svarim in the name of the Baal Shem Tov, but he never actually wrote those Svarim himself. The Baal Shem Tov never wrote any of his own Svarim. Now there's a legend that one time the Baal Shem Tov was walking along the way, and he saw someone. Now, between me and you, the real version of the story is that he saw a demon, a shade, but it's hard for me to tell over stories like that. So, the Baal Shem Tov saw someone walking around, and he was holding a sefer, a book, under his arm. And the Baal Shem Tov said to him, what's that sefer? What are you holding over there? And then the person said, well, it's the sefer that you wrote. It's your book. The Baal Shem Tov knew that he didn't write any books, so he said, can I take a look? Can I peruse that sefer? And he said, sure. So he took the sefer, he opened it up, he looked through it a little bit, and he realized that this was a transcription, maybe even a perfect transcription, of the shiurim that the Baal Shem Tov had given orally. And his reaction after seeing that transcription, after seeing the transcript and reading through it, the Baal Shem Tov said out loud, he exclaimed, "Ein kan afilu dibor echad she'amarti." There's not even one thing here in this book that I said. Not even one thing here did I say. Now, it was a transcript. It was the guy was almost a stenographer. He's writing down what happened in the shiur room, and yet the Baal Shem says, not even a single thing here was said by me. Now, the truth is that the Baal Shem Tov was trying to show us something, a feeling. He wasn't really making a point that he didn't say any of those words. He was trying to give over a message to us. And he was showing that really, really, from the beginning of the inception of Chassidus, and honestly, earlier in the Mesorah, earlier in our historical tradition, as we'll see soon, there was an aversion, there was a deep, discomfort with writing things down, with writing Divrei Torah down. The Baal Shem Tov wasn't avoiding writing down because he didn't have a pen and paper, or because he didn't have loyal chassidim who would be willing to write every single word that came out of his mouth down on paper and soak it up like it was the water that kept him alive. He knew he can get the Torah onto paper, but he avoided it. He was averse to it. He was uncomfortable with writing the Divrei Torah down. And the question that we want to start with today is, why is that so? You find it not only by the Baal Shem Tov, by the way. That focus on oral tradition, the mouth-to-mouth, the passing from person to person, the aversion to writing down the Divrei Torah, that was characteristic of so many of the first and second generation Hasidic greats. The vast majority of Sifrei Chassidus, the vast majority of all the books on Chassidus that we have that were published during those early generations were not published by the Rebbeim themselves. All the big Rebbes, all the big Hasidic masters that you've heard of, they didn't take pen to paper. They didn't write down the Divrei Torah themselves. Sometimes a student who wanted to maintain the Mesorah for posterity, sometimes a student who wanted to make sure that his Rebbe's Divrei Torah would last forever, he would write it down on paper, he would publish a book. But the Rebbe himself, very, very rare that he would write his own Svarim. one of the few examples, one of the very, very few examples of the early Hasidic Rebbeim who wrote down their own Divrei Torah is the Baal Tanya. Now, this is the Baal Tanya, the picture over here you see him calling us on FaceTime, the Baal Tanya, Rav Shneur Zalman of Liadi, the first Rebbe of Chabad Hasidus, the Alter Rebbe they call him. So he wrote a sefer called Tanya, which is how he got his name Baal Tanya. I have a friend who when he got married, he married a girl named Tanya, and his grandfather came over at the Vort and was telling every rabbi at the Vort, he's saying, "No, my grandson's the Baal Tanya now." So, I don't know, I think he was probably embarrassed at the time, but now he's happy because he can use that every time he quotes the Tanya. So, the Baal Tanya here is writing his Sefer Tanya, and he writes a Hakdama, he writes an introduction, and this is really the first paragraph of all of the writing that he does in this Sefer, and I want to read to you just one line, because it gives us a glimpse, just a taste, a hint, as to why it is that they were so averse, so scared to write down the Masorah. He says, "Hine modas zos, I'm showing you, I'm exclaiming to the public, Eina doma shmias divrei musar, Liriya, the Kriya Bisvarim. It's just totally dissimilar experience. You can't compare the hearing of Divrei Torah, hearing Divrei Musar with your ears from the mouth of a Rebbe, from the mouth of a guide, of a Baal Eitz, of someone who you care about to listen to, hearing the Divrei Torah, hearing the Musar, the ethical charge from his mouth, Liriyo Kriya Bisvarim, as compared to reading it in a Sefer." It's just Eino Doma. They're not similar. They're totally, totally distinct and separate experiences. And he goes on to explain that when you have a person who's reading Divrei Torah, he only has himself as his guide. As you read the Divrei Torah, you're processing the information, you're thinking about the information, you're culling some information and applying it to other aspects of your life, you're mulling over different parts of the pieces that were not focused on, that were bolded, that were not bolded. You're really the one processing each and every part of the Divrei Torah through your own filter of your head and your heart. Says the Baal Tanya, when you hear Divrei Torah from a Rebbe, from the mouth of someone you care about to listen to, from your guide, directly when you hear it from his mouth, all of a sudden, it's a different filter. It's a different lens. That Rebbe, that guy, that speaker, the person who's giving the Masorah, the Divrei Torah, the Musar over to you, he's able to transmit it in such a way that he designs it as he wants you to hear it. And he gives it over to you with the focus, with this being embellished, not that being embellished, with the stress on this Nekuda, not that point. He's able to craft it specifically the way that he wants you to hear it. And that is the advantage of hearing Divrei Torah from the mouth of the Rebbe, as opposed to reading it on your own through some book that he wrote down. Now, the Baal Tanya proceeds to write a book, a pretty long book, an amazing book, called the Tanya, and different igros, different letters that he published at the end of Tanya, but he shows here that he's uncomfortable. He has a reason that he's holding back, he has a reason he doesn't do it more often, he has a reason that his predecessors didn't do it, and he has a reason that he'd avoid it in the future. He just feels like he has to at this moment for very specific reasons. Now, what I wanted to do for the rest of the time today is to discuss not really the movement of Hasidus, so that we'll use it as a jumping point, and we'll bleen either Mir Tashem come back to it at the end, but I wanted to use this almost as a mashal, as a parable, as a starting point to say a diving board into a bigger question of, well, in general, we find this in the Masorah as well, in the tradition as well. In general, we find an aversion, at least lechatchila, at least the first attempt at holding onto our Masorah from Har Sinai to this very day, it was meant to be an oral tradition. It was meant to be transmitted orally. It was not meant to be written down. That was a quirk. That was an einfall. That was an invention out of nowhere by Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi when he recorded the Mishnayis that we should have Torah written down. Torah Shebaal Peh was always meant to be transmitted Baal Peh, orally, and I wanted to jump into discussing the whys, the whats, the hows of that transmission of the Masorah, but in order to do that, let's jump way back in time. Let's look at a Mishnah that was authored by none other than Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi, the author of all Mishnayos, the compendium, all the halachos that were transmitted orally until his time, and let's look at one Mishnah. It appears in the Daf Yomi recently, so it should be familiar to some of us. The one Mishnah in our Maseches Psachim that sort of gets us into this sugya, gets us into this discussion. The Mishnah Maseches Psachim, this appears on Daf Ayin Dalet that we're looking at right now. So anyone who's been learning Daf Yomi knows that we've been studying the laws of the Karban Pesach over the last, 3 weeks or so. And the Karban Pesach, it's pretty clear from all of these Gemaras, the last 20 blot, that the Karban Pesach is unique. It's different. It stands out. Most Karbanos have certain specific rules, and the Karban Pesach breaks a lot of those rules in a lot of different ways, and there's a lot of things to talk about. We're only really going to talk about one right now. One specific way is shown in this Mishnah. The Torah tells us that whereas all karbanos, all of the sacrifices that we usually offer that are eaten, not every sacrifice is eaten, not every karban is eaten, but most karbanos are eaten, so the ones that are eaten, so a person is allowed to cook, fry, boil their carbon however they so please. They could dip mustard, they could put pepper, they could really do whatever they want with the carbon and eat it as they please. Their preference is what determines how they should cook it, how they should prepare it, and how they should eat it. That's how we look at most carbonos. The carbon Pesach is different. And that's because the Torah tells us, in the Pesukim, the Torah tells us, you're not supposed to eat the carbon Pesach cooked, ki in tzli ish. The carbon Pesach is meant to be roasted by a fire. Tzli eish. It's supposed to be roasted by a fire and not some other heat source. So, first of all, we know it has to be roasted. And second of all, we know it has to be roasted by a fire. Okay, great. So, a direct roasting over the fire is what you need. Says the Mishnah, yeah, you need to roast it over a fire and not the following case. Look at the highlights with me. Ein solen es a Pesach. You can't roast the carbon Pesach. Lo al ha-shvud, not on a spit. Velo al ha-askala. And not on an askala is like a metal grill pan. So imagine, you know, a pan that's made of metal, a very, very shallow pan that's directly over a fire. The fire is beating on it. The fire is mamish heating it up very, very directly. But alas, the carbon Pesach is on the metal, not on the fire directly. That's no good, says the Mishnah. You can't roast the carbon Pesach al ha'askala on this metal grill pan. Amar of Tzadok, listen to this. You can't roast it on the askala. Amar of Tzadok, Rav Tzadok says, Maisa Rav Gamliel, there was a story, Maisa Shahaya, this is what happened. She Amar Letevi Abdo, Rav Gamliel said to his famous servant Tevi, he said, Sei Utslei Lanu Esa Pesach ala askala. Rav Gamliel says, go ahead and roast our carbon Pesach. How do I want you to roast it? Roast it on that askala, roast it on that grill pan. Now, you and I know that the Mishnayos are ripe for machlokas. It's fertile ground for machlokas, and it's perfectly permissible and expected that there will be machlokas, disagreement, arguments, quarreling, even sometimes very very intense quarreling in the Mishnayos. And it's not surprising that Rabbi Gamliel has a different opinion over here than the original opinion in the Mishnah. The first opinion in the Mishnah says you can't roast on an askala, on a fire grill pan, and the second opinion, Rabbi Gamliel says, yeah, you can. But the Gemara has a klal, the Gemara has a rule in general, that yes, there's plenty of room for machlokes, but you can never have a Mishnah that tells you the halacha, and then some story that contradicts it. If you want to tell me there's a machlokes, be a man. Tell me the truth. Rabbi Gamliel disagrees. Tell me straight. Rabbi Gamliel says, I disagree with the beginning of that Mishnah. I think that you are allowed to roast the carbon Pesach in such a way on the grill pan. Don't go beat around the bush and tell me, no, yeah, but there's a story Rabbi Gamliel did differently, and then we have to realize, oh, maybe he disagreed. They weren't so nice. They weren't trying to be so politically correct. Tell me the truth. Tell me like it is. Did Rabbi Gamliel agree or disagree? The Gemara does not allow for an opinion in the Gemara to be disputed or contradicted by a story. So here too, the Gemara in the very next daf on Ayin Heyam and Aleph and Mesechus Pesachim, the Gemara says, Maisa Listor, you're telling me a halacha. You can't roast the carbon Pesach on a metal grill pan because that's not directly roasting by the fire. Good, that's a halacha, I understand the halacha. Then you're telling me a Maisa Listor, a story that contradicts? Tell me the truth, is there a machlokas here? Don't tell me a story that happens to contradict and now I learn that there's a machlokas, a disagreement here. Maisa Listor, says the Gemara, no, we're misreading the Mishnah. Here's how you should really read the Mishnah. Chisure mechsura v'hachi katani. Chisure mechsura, the word chaser means lacking, right? Missing, just something's missing. Chisure mechsura, the Mishnah, listen closely, the Mishnah is missing words. V'hachi katani. This is what the Mishnah is meant to say. The Mishnah is missing words, and this is what it should really say. V'im askala menu keves mutter. You're not allowed to roast the carbon Pesach on an askala, on a fiery grill pan, a metal grill pan. You're not allowed to do that. Vim askala minu keves, but if it's one of those grill pans that has holes in it, that's mutter. That's permissible. That's okay. Why? Presumably because the fire will go through those holes, correct? And then it'll be a more direct roasting of the fire on the carbon Pesach. So the Mishnah tells you, don't roast on the fire pan, but if it has holes in it, it's okay. Then the Mishnah says, "V'amar Reb Tzadok, Ma'isa Brangam Liel Sh'amar Latevi Avdot Sei Utzlei Lanus Pesach Ala Askla Minu Keves." Says the Gemara, "No, the Mishnah was missing words. There's not really a dispute over here. Really, the Mishnah assumes you're not allowed to roast on a grill pan that has no holes. But if that grill pan has holes, mutter. And here's a story that actually corroborates that. Rabbi Gamliel one time wanted to roast his carbon Pesach in such a way, and he says to his servant, go roast the carbon Pesach on the grill pan, which has holes in it, which everyone agrees is permissible. Beautiful. Now we understand our Mishnah better. Except there's one major problem, no? Chisurei Mechsera? The Mishnah? The oral tradition from Har Sinai that Rebbe decided to write down because we were going to forget it.
all of halacha, the source of everything we do, every moment of our lives, chisurei mechzera, it's missing words, it's missing parts of our tradition, there are things that are lacking in the words of the holy Mishnayos. How can that be? And we should realize, by the way, this is not the first or last occurrence of a chisurei mechzera. There are more than 100 such occurrences in Shas Bavli, in the entire Talmud. There are more than 100 such occurrences. Curiously, it does not appear in the Yerushalmi. That's something for the academics amongst us to figure out a little bit, but the Yerushalmi does not employ this technique. But in the Bavli alone, there's 100+ such instances, and if you combine other similar instances that don't use the literal words chisurei mechzera, you'll find almost 200 or more such examples. So this happens all the time, chisurei mechzera, that there's some sort of lack in the Mishnah, but how could that possibly be? A break in our Masorah? A lack of words in the basis of every halacha and every attitude and every feeling that we're supposed to have since Har Sinai? It's missing in our Mishnayos, Tzarech Iyun Gadol. That is a major question and a really challenging one. And even though it sounds simple that we're starting with a question that we should have been asking our whole lives, unfortunately, I don't know how many of us have asked that question over the course of our Gemara learning. I don't know how many of us have asked the question, well, where did those words come from? Where did they go? How could it be there's such a lack of clarity in the Mishnayos? So what we want to do now is present a few approaches. This question was dealt with, you don't have to be embarrassed to ask such questions. This question was dealt with by the Rishonim, you know, in the medieval times, by the Achronim, all the way up to a couple years ago. People deal with this. This is an important question that needs to be asked, and needs to be approached, and needs to be answered. So let's offer a few approaches, and hopefully the final approach will launch us into a discussion that's really relevant to our lives, very directly relevant to our lives today. So the first answer comes from Rabbeinu Bechaya. Rabbeinu Bechaya is a 13th and 14th century Rishon. He was a student of the Rashba. A student of the Rashba, people really associate him with Ramban, Nachmanides, because his parish on Chumash, which is what you see in the picture over here, his commentary on Chumash was really, really in the style of Ramban, but he was actually most directly a Talmud, a student of the Rashba. So the Rabbeinu Bechaya asks this question. He wonders, how could it be that after all those years of the Masorah floating around, Baal Peh, orally, Rebbe decides finally that we're about to forget the Masorah, and he says, we gotta write it down, we gotta save the Masorah, we gotta maintain it. So he writes it down and preserves it, and yet he's missing words. Chisurei mechzera v'hachi ketani. There are times where there are words missing, we have to reshape, reformat the Mishnah in order to even understand, decipher what is being said. How can that be, says Rabbeinu Bechaya. And he gives a fascinating answer. He says, chisurei mechzera, yeah, there's a lack. There's a chisaron. You know where the lack is? You know what's missing? It's on our side. He says, Rebbe wrote everything perfectly, precisely. He did it in shorthand. He did it in note form. He did it in such a way that he included so much in so little. And chisurei mechzera, our heads can't quite make the ends meet. Our heads, our seichel, our intellect is not quite strong enough to be able to draw all the lines, to be able to connect all the dots, and really understand what Rebbe was trying to say. Chisurei mechzera, on our part we're lacking, v'hachi katani. This is what it really says in the Mishnah. Says the Gemara, you think this Mishnah is saying that the halacha is such, and Rabbi Gamliel did a maisa, a story that went the opposite? No. You're misunderstanding. Rebbe was hinting to us that the halacha is that you can't roast on a fire pan, a grill pan. But if it has holes, you can. And you see that Rabbi Gamliel did as much. Rabbi Gamliel did that in this story. And that's exactly what Rabbeinu Bechaya says is true about every chisurei mechzera. It's a lack on our intellect, a lack on our part, not understanding exactly how to put together the words of Rebbe in the Mishnayos. The author of the Mishnayos, Rabbi Yehuda Anasi. And we need the help of the Gemara, the Chachmei HaMasorah, the ones who carried our tradition past the Mishnah. We need their help in deciphering and putting it all together and really getting to the depth of what Yehuda Anasi was saying in his composition of the Mishnayos. That's what Rabbeinu Bechaya says, and it's corroborated by many Gemaras, by the way. Rabbi Yehuda Anasi, the one who authored the Mishnayos, was a master of the Hebrew language. You'll find the Gemara in Megillah, you'll find Gemaras elsewhere, where you see, this is very interesting, the Tanayim were struggling to understand a certain pasuk. They couldn't quite figure out what the pshat in the word metateya is, different pshat, different pesukim in Navi, and they didn't know what to do. And the housemaid, the Amsei Debei Rebbe, the housemaid in the house of Rebbe Yehuda Anasi, the author of the Mishnayos, overheard their discussion, and she said, oh, I could tell you the pshat in the psukim. He said, the housemaid is uneducated, she doesn't come to the Beis Medrash, what does she know? And she would say the explanation of the words in the psukim, and she'd get it right every time. Amazing. And we learned real pshatim and psukim from this. We learned real understanding of the psukim from this. How could that be? So the Rambam, in his introduction to his commentary on the Mishnayos, the Rambam spells out for us that Rebbe Yehuda Anasi, the author of the Mishnayos,
He was an expert, a bucky beyond belief, a totally proficient in the Hebrew language. He was a poet. He was incredible. And his housemaid even soaked it up. Even the woman who cleaned his house and took care of the materialistic things in the house, even she, with no education, never having been to the Beis Medrash, she soaked up, through osmosis, she gained a clarity as to the Hebrew language. And so she was able to teach a lot of the Rabbanim, a lot of the Tanayim, hey, you know what the Pasuk means? It means this or that. And that's because she got it from Rebbe, Rebbe Yehuda Hanasi, who was like the king of the Hebrew language. In fact, there's an interesting sefer called Minchas Ani. Minchas Ani is not a popular sefer at all. They happen to have republished it this year. I have I don't know what you can see and what you can't see, but up there on the top laying sideways, I have a copy of it. The Minchas Ani was republished this year by Machon Yerushalayim. It's a sefer of it's an encyclopedic work by a Rav named Rav Yosef David Zinsheim. Rav Yosef David Zinsheim was I think he was the chief rabbi of France, actually. He was the chief rabbi of France, I would say, the turn of the 19th century. The end of the 1700s, the beginning of the 1800s. So he was the chief rabbi of France. He was very much, he was close to the Chassam Sofer at one point. I think the Chassam Sofer gave a eulogy for him, in fact. He was a big gadol and a big genius. And he wrote an encyclopedic work called Minchas Ani. And in the third volume of this work, Minchas Ani, they published some responses, some tshuvos, some correspondences that he had with different people. Now, we're not actually going to quote Rav Zinsheim. We're going to quote the person who sent the question. But someone sent him a question in France in the late 1700s or early 1800s, and they asked him, what's the deal with these chisurim mechsuras? How could it be that the Mishnah is missing words? And the person who was asking the question had the audacity, when he was asking the question, to say, before you answer, Rabbi Zinsheim, I have an answer. Can I share it with you? And he shares his answer, and it's taka very good. And he says exactly what Rabbeinu Bechaya says. He says that Rabbi Yehuda Hanasi, the author of the Mishnayos, he had it all in mind. He had it all mapped out in advance. He knew exactly what he was saying, and he meant everything that the Gemara learns and gleans from the Mishnah. He meant it all, and he was able to include it and craft it in such a way that it's in the words, the very few words that he spares in the Mishnayos. That's the idea of Chisurim Mechsura. The Gemara is just doing, it's working backwards and finding out what Rebbe really meant. And he points to our Mishnah, and he says our Mishnah is a great example, because if you look back, and maybe we'll take a look for a second, if you look back, the Mishnah said, Ein solen es pesach lo al ashvod, you can't roast the Pesach on a spit, velo al ha askela, not on the askela, not on the grill pan. What do you mean, the grill pan? Hey, Ayadia, a specific grill pan? Are there other types of grill pans? Says this person who was asking the question, the Rav Zinsheim, yeah, there are two types of grill pans, no? One has no holes, and one has a bunch of holes in it. Says the Mishnah, Rabbi Yehuda Hanasi, lo ala askela, you can't roast it on the specific type of grill pan which has no holes. But if it has holes on it, you can definitely use that for the Karban Pesach. And that's why the next part of the Mishnah says that Rabbi Gamliel did exactly that. So that's just one example, but he gives three or four examples. But it just turns out that in a lot of cases, you know, you and I are not able to figure out what the missing words are and how to fill in the blanks. But in a lot of cases, the Gemara, the Chachmei HaMasorah, those who took care of the Gemara, were able to figure it out. And in some cases, they left it up to the determination of later Chachmei Doros. But either way, Rabbeinu Bechaya says it's all there. It's all included in the words. And that's really the way we're supposed to approach Chisurim Mechsura. It's a lack on our part, not on the part of Rabbi Yehuda Hanasi, Chas V'Shalom, or the Mishnah. The second approach is brought by the Vilna Gaon. Now this, between me and you, you would have expected to hear from like a professor in your college class, not necessarily from the Vilna Gaon, but that also makes it a little more interesting. The Vilna Gaon, if you see on top, that's a copy of the Sefer Pa'as HaShulchan, written by a student of the Vilna Gaon. This is from the introduction to the Sefer Pa'as HaShulchan. He quotes his Rebbe, the Vilna Gaon, the Gra, who says that really it's very interesting. The Gemara didn't feel bound by the Mishnayos. The Mishnayos recorded the halachos. They told us what the halacha was in many cases. But the Gemara didn't feel like it was tethered to the Mishnah in any way, and it felt like it had the right to disagree at certain points. And so, sometimes the Gemara says, you know what, I disagree with what the Mishnah thinks. And he says, in most cases, what a chisur or mechsur represents, this is very fascinating, is that the Gemara really disagrees with a stated opinion in the Mishnah. But it doesn't feel comfortable. It's a little crumb to say, nah, never mind that Mishnah. So instead the Gemara says, I know what we could do. We could twist and turn and flip over backwards and amend the text in such a way that it fits our understanding of the halacha. And that's what they did in order to preserve the integrity of the text of the Mishnah. This is really fascinating. You never would have said this on your own. But in order to preserve the text
and the integrity of the text, rather, of the Mishnah, so the Chazal and the Gemara would jump backwards, jump through hoops, try to find tricks to reread the Mishnah in such a way that they understand it to mean what they really want it to mean. So they kind of twisted the words of Rebbe to fit what they were trying to say. Now, he meant it in a much firmer way than I'm saying it, but obviously that's an interesting pshat that the Vilna Gaon was suggesting, and it's something that I think his students carried on in terms of learning the Mishnah. Is how you learn the Mishnah and how you learn the Gemara very much depends on how you look at these cases where the Gemara relearns the Mishnah. A third approach is that of Rabbi Yosef Cairo. That may or may not be a picture of him, but that's what you get on Google. So Rabbi Yosef Cairo was the Mechaber, the person who wrote the Shulchan Aruch, the person who wrote the Beis Yosef of the Svarim. So Rabbi Yosef Cairo has a sefer on Klalei HaTalmud, different rules about learning Gemara. And in the course of his discussions over there, he asks this question of how it could be Chisuri Mechzer, and this one's also going to surprise you. Rabbi Yosef Cairo suggests that here's what happened. Over the years, there was obviously only an oral tradition. There was no writing down. There was no notes. You find in the Gemara here and there hints that there were notebooks, personal notebooks that people kept. But basically, overall, in terms of transmitting the Masorah, there were no notes, there were no books, there were no Bar Ilan responsa. There was nothing to pass along the Masorah in any form of written word. Says Rabbi Yosef Cairo, the Shulchan Aruch, over time, what happens when you do that, when you're relying only on memory? You make mistakes. You forget things here and there. Whoa, this is scary already. You forget words here and there. Now, Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi, the one who wrote the Mishnah, he knew all the missing words. I mean, he knew what was missing. He knew when there was a lack. He knew when something had been forgotten or left out. He knew the mistakes. But by the time he came around to write down the Mishnah, this was the way everyone was telling over the Mishnah. So everyone knew the halacha, but forgot some words. So he figured, you know what, to preserve the Mishnah, the way it was passed down generation to generation, let me just leave it as is, with the mistakes, and let the future generations deal with it. Let me and you break our heads and try to read the footnotes in an art scroll to try to understand what in the world the Mishnah was trying to say. We get it right now. Amazing. The Mechaber, the Rabbi Yosef Cairo, says it was really mistakes in the Masorah. There were really glitches. There were really small things missing, small things added in some cases. There were little tiny quirks of mistakes in the Masorah, in the transmission of the Mishnayis. And Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi, the author of the Mishnayis, left them in there because he didn't want to bother people and throw off their memory. Unbelievable. That's what Rabbi Yosef Cairo says. And again, something you might have expected to hear from your teacher, as opposed to your Rebbe, but Rabbi Yosef Cairo is certainly our Rebbe, not our teacher, so it's something worth thinking about. I wanted to suggest once a different pshat, and I think I found later in the Achronim say the same thing. I wanted to suggest a different explanation, not like Rabbi Yosef Cairo, although similar in some ways, and it's based on a strange source, so get ready for the next slide. This is a book that I read, I want to say 9 years ago. I think the book came out about 10 years ago or something. I don't think it was so old that time. It's a book called Moonwalking with Einstein. That's the author in the FaceTime picture, Joshua Foer. Joshua Foer wrote this very fascinating book called Moonwalking with Einstein, to tell you the basic story, he was a journalist, he was an author, he was a writer, and he heard about this amazing competition that takes place, I believe, in New York City, at like a memorizing competition where people test their memory. So they'll get, 10... decks of cards in randomized order, shuffled, and they have to memorize the order of their packs, 10 packs, and they have to say them out to the crowd. And there's a competition with the winner of the memory champion every year. So Joshua Foer went to that competition in order to cover it as a journalist. And he met someone there who told him, he was asking, are you a genius? Were you always a genius? How does it feel to be a savant? And the guy said, I'm not a savant. I'm not a genius. Look at my scores. Look at my this. I'm not really so good. I just learned the trick. He said, there's a trick? Yeah, there's a trick. Of course there's a trick. And he said, I could teach anyone a trick. I think he quoted a specific celebrity who we're not going to mention during a shiur. He said, even that celebrity who doesn't have the biggest brains, even that person could learn this trick. And Foer, the author, was intrigued, and he decided to train. And he spent a year training his memory, learned the tricks. He went back and he won. And it's an amazing book where he records a lot of the history, a lot of the studies, and a lot of his experience over the course of that year. And it's a very, very fascinating book, and it actually helps with your memory if you're interested in working on these type of things. So in this book, he has, this is on page 128, 129, that area, he says like this, the brain best remembers things that are repeated, rhythmic, rhyming, structured, and above all, easily visualized. And he tells us from a certain episode in history where there are these bards, these Slavic poets,
who transmitted a masorah of their own, a tradition of their own, an oral tradition of poems throughout history, and they would pass it along from person to person for many, many years. And when you ask them, they would tell you, you would ask them, do you think you gave over the poem exactly as you heard it? And they would say, word for word, line for line. That's what they would say. And then you'd listen to the comparison of the two recitals, and you'd hear distinctions, like you'd hear differences. You'd hear words that were missing in one and added in others. And that was confusing to the people who were studying this, and the explanation that Foer wasn't the first one to discover. This was an old book called Singer of Tales, a researcher, Albert Lord, a very, very long time ago, who discussed Homeric poems, etc., etc. There's a lot to talk about. You can find a lot of it on Wikipedia, so you don't have to be too impressed with the Bichias. But basically what they discovered is that the way that these poets, these bards, would pass along their tradition is that they would not necessarily go word for word. Rather, and maybe read with me in the highlights over here, the big highlights, folklorists have compared oral poems to pebbles worn down by the water. They're made smooth over many retellings as the harder to remember pieces get chipped away or made easier to retain and repeat. Irrelevant digressions are forgotten. Long or rare words are avoided. Between imagery, alliteration, and having to fit the meter of the line, the epic bard, that poet, usually doesn't have that many possible words to choose from. The structure writes the poem. And basically what he's telling us is that over the years, in order to maintain a masorah, you have to tweak it. You have to fashion it in such a way that in order to remember the rhyme and the rhythm and the meter, in order to remember it exactly, you got to compact it, you got to make it perfectly fit into a song or into a poem, and that's the way you give it over to the next generation. And okay, if you want to make it rhyme perfectly, or if you want to make the beat perfectly, it's rhythmic and goes smoothly, so you're going to have to forget a word here or there, you're going to have to leave out a word, add a word, change a sentence a little bit, just tweak it the tiniest amount in order to actually ultimately maintain the masorah. And I wondered when I read this at the time whether that wasn't the explanation of what we're dealing with as well. There are words missing in our Mishnayos, absolutely. But it's not a mistake. It wasn't some oversight. It's that every person, every Tana who passed along the laws, passed along the Mishnayos over the generations, orally, from Har Sinai, each one had a personalized, individualized way of giving that over. And in order to remember what he was trying to remember, and in order to pass it along in the way that he wanted to pass it along, and in order to do it in the way that pedagogically he felt like it would be best maintained, best preserved for posterity, he shifted a few words. He made it fit better. He made the beat work better. He made a nicer rhyme. He took out some of the more difficult words. He added a hey into the word askala in order to hint at what he was trying to get at without compromising on the tone and the tune and the rhythm of what he was trying to give over. And in case you think that's too far off, in case you think that's too academic, because I did get the inspiration for it from a book that, although Joshua Foer is a Jewish individual, I believe he sponsors Sepharia. I believe he's pretty involved in Sepharia, actually. So he's a Jewish individual, but it's not a Jewish book in any such way. I do believe that this is what the Tiferes Yisrael was trying to say in Mishnayos and Arachin. The Tiferes Yisrael makes such a similar point, that really over the generations, things were not forgotten, but shifted intentionally in order to fit better into the concept and the construct of the Mishnayos that we're trying to give over. So those are four explanations of where in the world Chesura Mechzura comes from. Either it's all there and it's just a lack on our side, that's the firmest answer, that's what Rabbeinu Bechaya tells us, or maybe the Chazal were really shifting the words to make it fit their understanding as opposed to the Mishnah. Then we had Rabbi Yosef Cairo, who told us there were mistakes, there were little quirks of mistakes along the chain, and then we have this suggestion that perhaps, maybe, just maybe, the changes were intentional in order to make it fit even better. The fifth approach, and this is what we really want to get into now, the fifth approach is that of Rav Yitzhak Huttner. Rav Huttner in his Sefer Pachad Yitzhak on Chanukah, in the very beginning of the Sefer, he makes a very, very interesting argument. He says that every Chisuri Mechzura was intentionally implanted by Rebbe himself. Not by, like I said before, not by everyone over time who changed it to fit poems and meters and rhythms. No. Rebbe, when he composed the Mishnayos, he put in mistakes. He put in things missing. He shifted it so that it would be harder to understand. Why in the world would he do that? The answer is as follows. We know that the Torah Sheval Peh, the oral Masorah, the oral tradition, was not just by happenstance an oral tradition. The halacha says you were not allowed to write it down. It was a chiddush. It was an einful. It was an ingenious but scary move by Rebbe to decide to write down the Mishnayos. Until then, it was usur. It was forbidden to write down the Masorah. Why?
Because the Torah tells us, and this is darshaned by the Gemara in Gittin, the Torah tells us that the Torah Shval Peh is not allowed to be written down. You're not allowed. You're absolutely not allowed. Now, why are you not allowed to write down the Masorah, the Torah Shval Peh? So the answer, I think, the Maharal says in a few places, the Maharal explains that the Torah Shval Peh is Ein Ketz. It's limitless. It's endless. It has no boundaries. It's just impossible to fit into any physical construct. It's impossible to fit it into text, and it's impossible to get it all down on paper. It's Ein Ketz. It's endless. Now, the Maharal is maybe talking about the din and the halachos, but I think what he's really referring to is that there's much more than rules and laws and yeses and nos and how-tos and how-not-tos. There's actually a feeling, an attitude. There are ways we relate to society. All of that is given over in the Masorah, in the oral tradition. Now, if you write it down, you're going to be able to tell me, don't do that on Shabbos. Yeah, do that on Shabbos. That you can give over to me. But can you tell me how to feel on Shabbos? Can you tell me how to relate to that halacha? Can you show me with your face how, if you're going to violate the halacha, this is the right way to do it in certain instances? You can't give all of that over. All of the nuance, all of the detail, the qualitative, not quantitative, the qualitative detail that you want to put into the halacha, that's impossible to transmit in writing. Says Rav Huttner, that's why we couldn't write down the Masorah until now, and that's why when Rebbe wrote down the Mishnayos, he put in some mistakes, so that every time I'm learning a Mishnah, I have to read the words and be like, I have no idea what that is saying. Rebbe, can you explain that to me? Or you have to look at the Gemara and say, Chisuri Mechsura V'Hachi Katani, I will always rely on the oral tradition, even after it was written down, even after the text was put onto the paper. It's not enough because it's missing pieces, it's missing qualitative details, it's missing nuance, it's missing feelings and attitudes, it's missing a general approach and a specific approach of the Masorah that was passed along through the oral tradition until that point. Says Rebbe, I'll maintain it, I'll preserve it, I'm going to put in small mistakes, I'm going to leave some words out. And every time you're stuck, and every time you're trying to break your head over the words in my Mishnah, go ask your Rebbe. Go ask the Masorah. Go consult with the oral tradition and find out what I really meant. Because this chain will not break. We will make sure that this oral transmission persists and lasts for all time, even if we have to have it written down for the time being. Says Rebbe, I will be the one who guards the Masorah, even when I'm the one breaking the tradition by writing it down. Why were the Hasidim hesitant to write down their traditions? Why is it that over time, Klal Yisrael didn't want to have written text? Why is it over time that we were so averse to having written traditions as opposed to oral traditions? Well, maybe it's for this very reason. The whole movement of Hasidus, specifically, and the whole movement of Yiddishkeit in general, is not meant to give over yeses and nos. It's not meant to give over the whats and the hows and the very specific rigid formal formulae that you're supposed to live your life by. It's meant to give over a rubric, a construct, a feeling, an attitude, rhythms and flows of life that are supposed to be applied to the halacha. There's so much nuance. There's so much qualitative detail above and beyond the quantitative detail. There's so much to learn, not from the words, but from the way they're said. The Hasidish Rebbes, they didn't want to give it over because they wanted to make relationships. They wanted to pass along a feeling, a spirit, an attitude towards halacha, an attitude towards Jewish life. And Rebbe, he didn't want to just write down the halachos. He didn't want to just tell you, here's what to do, here's what not to do. He wanted to tell you, here's how to do that, here's how to feel when you're doing that, here's how to relate to the halacha, and here's how not to relate to other things, to society, to the world around us. This is what the Masorah was meant to encapsulate, and this is what Rebbe was trying to accomplish when he wrote it down in such a way that, hey, I got to go back to the oral tradition. Even if I have it all on paper in front of me, it's not really all there. Chisuri Mechsura, the Hachi Katani, there are things missing because Rebbe wanted it that way. He wanted us to have to look back and find the answers from our tradition. In this week's Parsha, just yesterday, we read, or some of us read at home, but we read the Pesukim B'chol Ha'Amrom Esakolos at Har Sinai. We saw the sounds. We were able to visualize audio experiences. That was some amazing, miraculous experience. Vesalapidim, Veskola Shofar, Vesahar Ashen. This just sound and light show, incredible laser show, unbelievable that HaKadosh Baruch Hu performed us with miracles, with Nisim. Not just that there was a fire, and not just that there were loud sounds, but that the fire was felt and the sounds were seen. A Pella, an incredible, incredible Nis. Now ask the Brisker Rav Yitzhak Zev Soloveitchik, Rav Velvo, we call him. So ask Rav Velvo, what in the world? HaKadosh Baruch Hu doesn't just do magic tricks. He doesn't do magic tricks just to impress us. He doesn't do them just because they're cool. He doesn't do them for no reason whatsoever. He doesn't do magic tricks willy-nilly. Nason don't happen for no reason. There's always a reason, a prescribed, you know, a svara, a logic behind the nes. So what was the logic behind this nes? Why did HaKadosh Baruch Hu have to make Har Sinai so that you could see the sounds, that you could visualize things that are usually only heard by your ears? Why would that be? Why would HaKadosh Baruch Hu, why would Hashem do that? Now, this is a little bit using what the Brisker Rav answered, but also a little bit embellishing. I think the pshat is, along the lines of what he said, I think the pshat is exactly what we're talking about. In order to have a Har Sinai, a Maimon Har Sinai, a Matan Torah, where we receive the true, full Torah, Shebechsav, Shebal Peh, everything that would transpire over the course of the Masorah for the rest of time, we needed to see sounds. We needed to be able to pick up on nuances that our normal usage of the five senses would miss. We needed to find a way to be totally absorbing the Masorah and every fiber of our being and be able to bring it into ourselves through our ears, through our eyes. We need to experience it in such a way that it really permeated our very being. So HaKadosh Baruch Hu said, here's a nes, here's a miracle, you can see the sounds. You can actually visualize the audio, an audio-visual experience at the highest level to give us the Masorah at the highest, fullest level. So we can really, really internalize what we were trying to see. The feelings, the rhythms, the flow, the attitude, the halacha, but also what's behind and what goes into and what is infused into the halacha. And that's why HaKadosh Baruch Hu made Har Sinai v'chol ha'amroim es ha'kolos, so that we could visualize what we were hearing, and we could hear what we were visualizing, and we could take it all in the strongest way possible. This is my first time giving a Wayu Kol Yom Rishon Shir, so Rabbi Shor, this might be my last, but I did intend to poke fun at Wayu Torah. Over the past couple years, I have thought about this, and if you've been in any of the shuls that I've worked in, I've darshaned on this more than once. The Wayu Torah phenomenon is incredible. It has been an unbelievable, uplifting experience for all of Klal Yisrael, and you haven't muted me yet, because I've only said good things. And it's only been positive in those ways, and we had an event, I think, a year or two ago, celebrating that, how amazing the Masorah has been uplifted through Wayu Torah, the sheer listening experience. That is incredible. But it's chisure mechsura. It's a little bit chisure mechsura. It's missing that interaction. It's missing that personal face-to-face. Did he say that with a positive spin, with a negative spin? Did he mean there are exceptions? Can I ask a question? What's the feeling in the room? Was there tension building up as he was saying it? It lacks. It lacks a little bit. It's chisure mechsura in terms of the experience. The tochen, the content is there, but the experience is a little lacking. And Baruch Hashem, you know, a tiny, tiny, tiny silver lining in the horrible, horrible occurrences over the past year has been the evolution of a Talmud Torah into the Zoom room and the ability to learn and share Torah in this space. And you know what? It picked up on the slack a little bit. It did. The chisuri mechzer was a little bit filled in. You can see me. You realize that I'm too skinny and don't look healthy when I talk. You realize my voice is a little too high-pitched. You hear the way I'm passionate about this and not passionate about that. You chop all of the nuances. Yeah, that is working. And yet, there's still a little chisuri mechzer, no? Even with this visual experience of Zoom, and this is just one article of many, there have been many, many studies about this already, Zoom is lacking. This web experience of teaching Torah and learning Torah, it is lacking. If you look in the middle paragraph, sometimes you'll hear the teacher say something, and you find yourself wondering as you look at their face, as you watch the lips move, as you look at the people around you in the room, did she say, I'm confused about the assignment as an accusation? Was it an inside joke? Is it because she needed clarification? Was she showing leadership? Was it inviting clarification? Was that laughter at me or with me? All of these things are missing. The content, the information are there, but the meaning and the nuance and those small things that we usually pick up on, sometimes it's a little static, sometimes your eyes dart to a WhatsApp message, sometimes it's just hard to stare at a screen for that long, and for the teacher, honestly, I have no idea if you've been looking at me for the last 45 minutes. I have no idea if your audio is on. I might be muted. Everyone here might be from my family and you're just trying to stack the numbers. I have no idea. I can't tell because your video is off. And the experience is lacking. Chisurei mechzera. V'hachi gatani. We have to go back at some point to try to consult the Masorah. We have to at some point go back, and b'siyat d'shmaya, it should be very, very soon that this will all be over and be able to join together and learn together in person, but we have to make sure that this does not become the new normal. We have to make sure that it's not just chisuri mechzera, v'hachi katani. It has to be that we go back to consulting the Masorah, go back to the way it was done, the way it is done, the proper way of roem es ha'kolos, of experiencing the Masorah, of experiencing Talmud Torah, the nuance, the detail that goes into it, and that day should come soon. Until then, It's a little bit of a poor connection. It's a little bit of a transmission of Torah over FaceTime that's lacking, that's chisurim echsera. But the bracha and the tefillah is that b'siyat d'shmaya, very, very soon, we should all go back to the classroom, go back to making relationships with our rabbi and with our teachers, go back to learning from the Masorah, in the Masorah. And Mirta Hashem, I would look forward to embracing those experiences together with many of you. Thank you so much for having me, and have a wonderful day.
Thank you so much. That was wonderful.